This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 141. Today's episode was brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create your portfolio website for your photography, a blog, or an online store. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and an incredible 24/7 customer support staff. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. Today, you are joined by thousands and thousands of photographers from all over the world. Thank you all for your support. You have generated millions of downloads in the 141 episodes that we have done. So we appreciate everything that you guys do for us. Today, we are ready to give value to you. We have asked on the Improved Photography Podcast listeners group on Facebook. That's not a page. This is a group where we all can all talk back and forth and chat with each other, and you can ask questions. So go search that on Facebook, Improved Photography Podcast. And it's a small group. You got to get approved to get in there, but we'll let you in. There are no secret handshakes necessary. And so we got questions from there that we're going to talk about today. I have Nick Page and Darren Meller on the line, ready to answer your questions. Timothy Donnelly asked the first one. He says he's shooting mainly portrait and macro photography, but because of a medical issue he has, sunrises and sunsets are really tough to shoot. So how do you deal with the harsh light of day? Well, if you were a landscape photography, Timothy, I might say you're kind of out of luck. Not that you can't take landscape photography in the middle of the day, but it's going to be so frustrating for you trying to get that one special situation where it kind of works. It's probably going to be more frustrating than fun. Portrait and macro photography, absolutely you can do this during the middle of the day, especially macro. When I'm shooting macro photography, the secret weapon, silver bullet, is a 5-in-1 reflector. I mean, just get a $20 5-in-1 reflector, flip out the translucent side and hold it over the flower, the insect, the whatever you're shooting. And suddenly that harsh light of the day is gorgeous. And because you're only shooting a tiny little area, a reflector is going to easily change that. So there's no reason why you can't shoot macro photography any time of the day. That's a great subject for you to shoot. Now, portrait photography can be a little bit trickier. Now, it's not too difficult to get the lighting right on the model during the middle of the day. Again, we could just use a scrim, which is a large diffusing panel that goes over a person that you're taking a picture of, and you'd get great soft light. But the problem is the background. The background is still going to be nasty hard light. So there are a few things you can do. One, you can really use a ton of flash. I mean, 4 speed lights, 5 speed lights on the subject. And then that's going to be able to darken down the background because you have so much light on the subject. When you expose for them, the background can dim down quite a bit. And that can lessen the effect of the midday light that you're using for your portrait. Another option that you could do is just specialize in studio photography, and then this is no issue at all. So don't let your limitations be an excuse for not getting great photos, but don't go out and do the kind of photography that's just not going to work, except for in very specialized situations. So landscape photography is probably not going to be a good option there. Portrait and macro, absolutely you can do this.
Absolutely. And another tip that I have is to just shoot in the shade. When you're in the shade, you get a nice, soft, even light on everything, especially for portraits. It's like cheat mode for portrait photography. Like if you want to just quickly take a really awesome shot, just move the shade, snap a picture, and voila, you're done. So the shade is definitely your friend, even in midday.
And next on the docket, we have a question from Stephen Miller. He has 4 points that I'll summarize real quickly. He wants to know, after Nick's and Jim's real estate battle, why ISO 100 if the MLS website is already crunching the image down? He wants to see if he can cheat up on the ISO. His second point is he wants Jim to talk a little bit more about the FAA's proposed rules of no commercial use with drones. His third point is whether or not you can truly get away with using a tool like Photomatix to get a proper neutral exposure. And last but not least, he heard you two mention using F-16, and he thinks that is overkill, and he shoots at F-6.3 and wants to know why you chose F-16 as a starting point. So let's just let you guys jump in.
Nick, you said the ISO 100 thing. Let's hear that.
Okay, so I shoot everything assuming that it's going to go somewhere other than just some crappy website. So my excuse for shooting ISO 100 is that I push my files fairly far. I boost the shadows quite a bit. And anytime you do that, ISO 100 is a lot better than ISO 400. So a lot of the things that I shoot, they either go in a magazine or they go into some kind of printed flyer. And you can tell a difference in those mediums between ISO 100 and 400. On a website, not so much.
All right. Now, his second question was about the FAA rules of no commercial use in the United States for drones. So this is used very commonly in real estate photography to get that elevated perspective looking down on the scene. And I have a Photo Taco episode coming out on this really soon. So if you're only getting the Improved Photography podcast and not the other shows that we do, you are a crazy person. Well, we have a new podcast episode coming out for you every day of the week. We don't want your commute to be boring. So check it out. The Photo Taco podcast is another show from the Improved Photography Network. I know a lot of you are missing out on it. So in that episode, I explain a little bit about the FAA rules. Basically, what the law is, says you can't use unmanned aerial vehicles or these little quadcopters or the drones for any commercial purpose. And they're very specific about this. The law even says that if you are intentionally gathering even breaking news, can't use a drone. But if you're flying your drone and it just so happens that breaking news starts where you happen to be filming, that's okay. You can then use that for a commercial purpose. So if you fly your drone up and suddenly mob violence breaks out where you're flying your drone, that's the one little carve out they make for commercial use. They're being really strict on this. However, you can get a Section 333 exemption to the law that will allow you to use your drone for commercial use. And at first, these were really slow to come out, but now the FAA has already given out 1,543 exemptions, so they're coming out at a pretty regular basis. Go check my article on improvephotography.com from this week, or just search drone law when you get to improvephotography.com. And I have an article that'll walk you through exactly the process you need to go through. Basically, you just write a letter and you have to hit on certain points, explain why you're doing this and why you want to do it, submit it to the FAA, and the vast majority of those petitions are being accepted. So it takes 120 days to get this done, but it's now realistic to use your drone for aerial photography.
Alrighty, and the third point is whether he respectfully disagrees with the use of photomatics. So why do you guys not recommend using the HDR or something like that, I think is what we talked about last time.
I definitely think that you get a more natural look in Lightroom, personally. I know that there's different modes in photomatics that you can use to get a more natural result. Personally, I just like the Lightroom look better. It's agree to disagree, I think, is that where
Well, the other thing that I might add on this is, I think Photomatics photos can look great, just as really as Photoshop or better. But real estate photography is usually a volume kind of industry. You got to do a lot of volume to make some money. And so if you're really bracketing all these shots and going through, wow, baby, your margins are going to be nothing.
Right.
So I don't know. I can it produce a great result? Yes. And if it's working for you, do it. I don't have a problem with it. But I will say that as I look at it on the MLS, and I'm hoping to move right now, our house is listed for sale. I have not yet seen an HDR photo that I actually like. So yes, can it be done right? Yes. But I'm saying 100% of the photographers that I've seen on the MLS recently are not doing it right. And they probably think, no, everybody else is doing too much. I do it great. You just got to be real careful there. Next, F-16, is it necessary for real estate photography? No, of course it's not, especially if we're talking about small photos. Mm. But you know what? You're going to be on a tripod anyway. And so why not use F-16? Well, your shutter speed is going to be half a second slower. Big whoop.
So he's mentioned that he's shooting an ISO 400 and an F6.3. So I'm guessing maybe
he's trying to get rid of the tripod.
Yeah, I think that he might be shooting handheld.
And that's okay.
Right. And it also depends on what camera body you're using. Because if you're using a crop sensor, F6.3 probably is enough.
That probably is fine. Yeah, you're right. Good point.
Mm-hmm. But that also means that ISO 400 is more noisy. So yeah, double-edged sword there.
Double-edged sword. All right. Chris Chandler says, so will a 17 to 50 millimeter crop lens, such as the Sigma, have the same look as a 24 to 70, or does it compress like a wider angle lens? In other words, in order to get the look of a 100 millimeter portrait lens, I would actually have to get a 100 millimeter lens and move further away from the subject. Okay. When you're shooting a full frame, 24 to 70 or 70-200, those are the lenses we hear about all the time, right? Everybody's got a 24 to 70, 70-200, and you want to get that same thing on a crop sensor camera, yes, you would want to get something like a 17 to 50, something that mimics that for a crop sensor camera. So when I switched to Fuji, I was on full frame Nikon, and then I switched to crop sensor Fuji. And so I don't want a 24 to 70 because that's more zoomed in than I want for my lens. So I get a 16 to 55. And that basically mimics a 24 to 70's focal length on my camera. So yes, there is that crop factor, but you know what? I wouldn't worry about this so much because there's nothing like magical about the 24 to 70 focal range. I often see this when people are talking about buying a 70-200 and they're like, oh yeah, but that's like whatever it is, 115 to 275 on my camera. And I always think, so what? That's a great focal length, right?
Right.
Just because it's different doesn't mean it's bad. I guess that's my point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The only difference you're going to notice between those two lenses on a crop sensor and on a full frame is that the depth of field. You're going to have a shallower depth of field on a full frame at those same focal lengths than you would on a crop sensor. So, you know, if you're shooting a 50 millimeters on a crop sensor and 70 millimeters on a full frame, you're going to have a much blurrier background on the full frame photo than you would on the crop sensor photo. That's going to be the main difference that you notice, I think.
And we have another Fuji question. We have one from Todd Grimm, and Jim's probably going to be able to answer this one really easily. Essentially, Todd Grimm wants to know what his options are with buying a Fuji X-T1 with all the mirrorless talk we've been doing lately. He's looking to replace his D7100 and wants to get the Fuji X-T1 with the 35 f1.4, and he's wondering whether that would be a better choice over the X100T.
Well, they're both great cameras. The one that I would look at that wasn't mentioned in this question is the Fuji X-T10.
Great camera.
The Fuji X-T10 is like the almost twin of the X-T1. The price is significantly cheaper, but you get like 95% of what an X-T1 is. So you've got to check out my article on improvephotography.com or heck, just Google it. Just Google 10 best mirrorless cameras under $1,000, and I'll kind of walk you through this answer. But if this is what you're describing, you probably want the Fuji X-T10. All right, Giovanni Paredes says, have any of you show hosts had any experience selling with offset stock photography or any other country companies other than iStock? Then he's heard that offset pays way more. Now, there are a lot of companies that pay way more than iStock. The question is, are they actually going to sell? Just because you get a higher percentage doesn't mean you're going to make more money. So it's a tough question. Really, the way to find out is try it. I have tried a couple of the other stock companies. I haven't spent a ton of time here. It probably pays to you know, put them on all of them, unless you've signed the exclusivity agreement with iStock, which I would rarely recommend you do. Then, you know, post it on a bunch of them. There's an easy way to find out. But in my preliminary test, not having tried this specific microstock agency, iStock still is the 500-pound gorilla.
Nelson Tapias, he's curious about the Black Rapid strap. He says that it's putting the socket's putting unnecessary stress on the tripod socket and from heavy lenses. And he's wondering whether or not switching back and forth from the tripod plate is the best route or whether there's a better option. What does Improved Photography team use? I'm actually curious to see what Nick thinks because he was using that one clasp.
Yeah, so I've used the Black Rapid straps for quite a while. And actually, there is a way to work around having to switch your tripod plate back and forth. Because I use an L bracket, the bottom of the L bracket that I have, the Sunway Photo L bracket, it actually has a 1/4-20 thread, so you can just put your mount directly into the bottom of your tripod plate, and then you don't have to keep taking that plate off and on. And with the heavier lenses, when I think heavier lenses, I'm thinking the 70-200, you're not mounting your strap to the bottom of your camera. You're mounting it to your tripod collar on your lens. And, you know, it's designed to be able to pack its own weight. So I really don't worry about the extra stress on it too much. I'm not worried about it stripping out or anything. One thing I will recommend is that you make sure that you get the name brand screw-in dealy bobs. What are those called? It's like the little eye bolt, the little eye bolt that your strap, you know, hooks onto. Make sure you get the name brand one of those, because you want to make sure that those are made with good material, because that's really the only thing that can fail on the strap, and it's not a good thing if it falls off or breaks. So yeah, just make sure you get use the name brand ones. And if you're using an L plate or some kind of plate that actually has a threaded hole on the bottom, you won't have to, you know, keep taking your tripod plate off.
Very cool. Paul Bickley asks, what lighting setup would you recommend for shooting Halloween single and group portraits? He was thinking about putting a flash high and coming down on the people. Well, I think that's a great option. That's something that I do actually really often, and I don't see other photographers doing very much, is get a really high light stand, or a C stand is better, where it goes straight up and then curves it and then comes at an angle, like a 45 degree angle. That's what a C stand is. And then putting a big soft light, but directly over the top of the model's head. And it's soft, so it will, it's not going to put like nasty hard shadows in the eye sockets and stuff. But there's such moody shadows, and there's such fall off, meaning it's brighter at the top of the body than at the bottom of the body. It's like the most dramatic lighting you could possibly get. Just put one light directly over the person. In fact, watch when you're watching like a, you know, CSI movies, or, you know, cops get the bad guys kind of movie. Whenever they get in the interrogation room, they always have like this convenient little light, like a pendant light hanging down right over their head. And it's because it creates this kind of very dramatic lighting. But another thing to consider is, especially if you're taking pictures of your kids this Halloween, don't just snap a snapshot of them as they're walking out of the door. Like, take whatever costume they're doing and do some kind of cool conceptual shoot of whatever they are. If they're going to be Iron Man, well, let's composite them on a, you know, buildings in the background and make it look like they're flying. And fire, always fire in these photos. I've done this a few times with my kids, and they love it. And the results have been super cool. Things that I'll always remember of having with my kids.
And if they dress up as zombies, it might actually be cool to increase the ISO, because that graininess kind of gives it that creepy factor.
I picture a zombie as being a grainy thing.
There you go.
Spog McArdle says, I am red-green colorblind, which means I see shades of some colors different than normal eyes. Any ideas on how to be able to edit like you can do? Should I just use presets? About 1/8 of the male population is colorblind. Love to hear your thoughts. Okay. There are a number of very well-known colorblind photographers. And so I'm not going to worry about this a whole lot. This is very possible to get around. What I would do is just do the best you can. And when you're done with the photo, have somebody else, a spouse, a friend, whoever, come in and kind of spot check your work. Mm-hmm. And then learn how you need to adjust based on their feedback of how most people are going to see it. And over time, as you see, oh, whoa, you're crazy on the greens, you'll learn what you can do. Also, you can kind of let the sliders be your guide. You'll learn kind of what your camera is capturing in terms of color, and you'll just learn how far you can push sliders certain ways before it starts to look a little bit crazy. So don't let this be an excuse that holds you back. I think using these couple ways to adapt can totally fix the problems for you.
Yeah, totally.
And Eric Pasoda's question, this is really nerdy for me, so hopefully Jim can tackle this one, and maybe Nick has something to weigh in on it, but it's about ISO invariance. Is that correct? During shooting?
Invariant. Yeah, that's ISO invariance.
Invariance. Yeah. Oh, I added an extra syllable. He's asking whether or not it's better to use an identical ISO during capture, or whether or not it's better to increase the exposure. So there's two types of grain you can get. One where you increase the ISO, which is analog grain, and the other one is to increase it in post-processing, which is a digital gain in increasing the grain within the shot. So what's the best way to do so to make it much easier to avoid blowing out the highlights? This is really nerdy, so right. I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say.
I will totally take this one. It's always better to expose the photo as much as you can without overexposing the highlights. And the easiest way to make sure that you don't overexpose your highlights is just turn on your highlight notification or your highlight warning setting. So when you review your photo, if you have any blown highlights, they'll blink at you. They're called the
blinkies. Oh, Jim loves blinkies.
Yeah.
I hate blinkies.
But they're so useful. And that way, you know.
They're awful. They get in the way.
But they're awesome because you know whether if you've overexposed something, it's going to warn you and let you know. And the reason you want to expose the photo as much as you can without overexposing your highlights, it's something called shooting to the right. Anything to the right of your histogram on your camera, you're actually recording far more color detail or detail in general than you are at the left side of your histogram. So the brighter you expose your photo, the more detail your camera is capturing. So by underexposing and then boosting it up, you're actually going to get way lower quality colors, less detail, all kinds of stuff. The noise might be relatively the same, but the colors are going to be lame in comparison. So exposing the photo as much as you can without overexposing your highlights is always the right way to go. And that's referred to as shooting to the right. So just turn on your highlight warning and you're good to go.
Don't do it. Okay. So you can turn on a highlight warning so that whenever you take a photo and your highlights are clipped, they're completely white. The brightest parts of the picture are too bright. It blinks at you like, warning, you might have done something creative with your exposure. Stop that. Right? Yes. Like, it's so annoying because, you know, fine. If you're using landscape photography, it kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. But then you go to shoot like night photography and all the stars blink at you like, warning, this is white. And you're like, yeah, it's supposed to be white. And then you go to shoot a model and you just want to blow out the sky and expose for the model. That's fine. And it's like, warning, you've done something creative with your exposure. It totally gets in the way. I can't stand those things.
Yeah, and it takes you like all of like 5 seconds to turn it on and off. It's not that big a deal to like when you
not you're before going it annoys me. It only takes 5 seconds for me to get annoyed.
This is true.
All right. Before we go on to all the other questions that we have, we want to take a second and thank our sponsors for supporting the podcast. Animoto is an excellent supporter of the Improved Photography Podcast. Animoto is the best way to add some motion to your still photography. They create the slideshows for you. You just upload it and they'll put it all together in a professional package for you. You can download it, put music on it, drag and drop the interface. You can mix still photos with video clips. It really is a very, very nice piece of software. And it's at a very reasonable price. But last week I shared a little tip with you and it really does work like magic. So I want to make sure you got it. All of us are trying to get a little bit more attention to the things we're doing in photography. And so if you have a Facebook page or even on your personal page where you're posting your photos, especially if you're doing this professionally, a really cool tip is if you're just going to share two or three photos from a senior photo shoot or whatever, you would normally just put the photos on Facebook, upload them and post it. But guess what? Your post won't go out to nearly all the people that have friended you or followed you. And so the way to kind of get around this is to post videos. Facebook loves video content. And so you can do this with Animoto. Just take the 4 or 5 photos you're going to do and drop it in to make the world's fastest slideshow. And Animoto makes it easy for you. And upload that to Facebook and bang, your post will get out to way, way, way more people. And of course, you can make the full featured beautiful slideshows as well to give to a client, to use at your family reunion. Thanksgiving is coming up. There'd be a great time to do an Animoto slideshow for your family. There are a lot of ways to use it. I love Animoto. You can go to animoto.com/improve and use promo code improve to get 15% off an annual pro subscription. That's animoto.com/improve. And we thank them for supporting Improve Photography. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is who I use to make my website, and who Darren Miller uses to make his website, and Nick Page uses to make his website. And we all use it. We all used it before they were a sponsor of Improved Photography because, well, they're really good. It's very easy to make your website. It shows the photos huge. It's mobile responsive, so it works on any device. You know, you go on an iPad, it looks like it's custom made for that iPad. On your phone, custom made for that phone. It's really just a beautiful interface. In fact, just in the 5 minutes before we started recording, I went on and I thought, I wonder what a new theme would look like. And boom, it's just right there. If you ever get a little bit tired of the look of your website, want to switch it up, I mean, you're just a few clicks away. And I love that about Squarespace. They also have really awesome support. If you're ever in a pinch, can't figure out how to do something on your website, 24/7 customer support. That is awesome. And it starts at just $8 a month. That kills the competition in terms of pricing. So check it out at squarespace.com and use offer code improve for a really nice discount of 10% off your first purchase. Thank you for showing your support of Improved Photography and for supporting Squarespace. All right, let's go on to all the questions that we have here. We have a ton more. Let's go to Austin Tyler Swenson, who says he has a full-time job early in the morning. And so he can really only work, Saturday mornings and a couple other mornings to make a little side income as he's trying to move into photography full-time. And he's in a very tiny town. Sound familiar to both of you guys? I think you're both in similar situations at one point. So what kind of suggestions do you guys have of transitioning into more photo work when there really aren't that many people to market to? Nick, this sounds like he's just a page out of your life.
Yeah, no kidding. No pun intended. A page out of my life.
Oh, yeah. Very good. I'm going to use that a lot now. You're going to regret the day you reminded me of that pun.
So for me, like, it's all really about networking. Network with other business owners. A lot of businesses, they need headshots of some kind. And once you get your foot in the door with enough people that that are willing to just use you for your cheap price in the beginning, once you get your foot in the door and you start building that network, you can pretty much just completely dominate your small little area. And that's kind of what I've been doing. My little town that I live in is like, I don't know, 3,000 people maybe. Granted, I've branched out a lot since then, but I got my start in this little town. And once you photograph one person, the chances are that there's not a whole lot of other photographers in your small little community. So once you begin networking, you're going to be the photographer guy. So just begin networking by working with other business owners, do some headshots for, you know, the lawyer down the street, or do family pictures. It depends on, you know, what type of photography you're wanting to do, but just get your start in with other business owners. That's what I would like to do. That's what I would recommend.
That's great advice.
Totally. I did it backwards. I'm sure that Austin has some bigger communities around him. Maybe go to the bigger community, start proving yourself there because there's more opportunities, and then make your way back to the smaller town with a larger portfolio. I actually did that because Omaha, Nebraska is very close to me. Did tons of shoots for clients up there. And now that I have a body of work, all these people are from the small town of about 5,000 here are calling me up.
You're like, hey, there's somebody on your portfolio I've never seen before. Nick, I really liked your advice. I had a similar experience when I started Improved Photography. I started the website, and you know, you can look at your analytics to see how many people go to the website. And I looked at it and I was like, ah, man, only like 100 people have come to my website this month. And I remember I said that to somebody, and somebody said, man, 100 people came to you to learn about photography? Wouldn't you be like so excited if you got to teach a class to 100 people in a conference center about mm-hmm. photography? And I thought, you know, that's a different way of looking at it. I hadn't really thought about it that way. And it just provided me the motivation to go on. And now millions of people have come to improve photography, to learn about photography, because I had that motivation when I started. So, you know, you see this little town and you say, oh, man, there aren't that many people here. But you know what? You got 2,000 weddings, or you got 2,000 births. You got 2,000 first grade pictures. You got 2,000 second grade pictures. You got 2,000 soccer games. You got 2,000 weddings, 2,000 quinceañeras, 2,000 first babies. Yeah, I mean, you have opportunities galore. And, you know, if you're good enough, own that little town. Even if it's small, take what you can do and build on it. 2,000 people, if you have really had 2,000 clients, you do just fine as a photographer. So that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Chris Ashworth has a similar situation to what my dad did with his glasses. He says he has glasses and he's using the eye cup, but it's putting smudges on his glasses without the eye cup, and the plastic piece will scratch them. He'd like to hear our thoughts with dealing with glasses when shooting, and can he take his glasses off and adjust his diopter control to be in focus with his eye without the glasses? I say don't go to that trouble. Just go on Amazon and see if there is an extender. My dad bought a Canon extender for his Canon 6D, and it actually extends the little view thing that you look through, and the cup, it goes out further. No smudge from his nose on the LCD screen. And also, it's much more comfortable. He can keep his glasses on, and it's a clean day for both his LCD screen and his bifocals.
Very cool. Yeah, if you can adjust the diopter to keep your glasses on and it's comfortable, then do that. Then you don't have to take them off every time. All right, Shane R. Fairburn basically sounds like he is tired of the gear and all the technical stuff and the arguing over the tiny little things that don't make much of a difference in photography. So where do you draw the lines? And he said he knows it's kind of a subjective question. You know what? This used to really bother me as people were talking about all the really technical things in photography and not seeming to get to the creative stuff. It's definitely important that we get to the creative stuff, but you know what? It's just fun. So if you enjoy talking about the technical stuff, then talk about it. If you enjoy learning about it, then learn about it. Photography is supposed to be fun. And so if you enjoy that stuff, sink into it. And if you don't really care for that stuff as much, you know, press the 30-second skip when we're talking about it and wait till we're getting to more of the creative stuff. You know, photography is what you want to make of it. And so if you don't like that part, skip it. But I will say that a lot of the things that seem trivial as you're starting out in photography, you eventually find that a great photo is made out of not just one big silver bullet tip. It's about 1,000 tiny little things that all work together in the photographer's head to make a masterpiece.
Yep.
Nick was just saying before we recorded something that I thought was so true. He was saying that, you know, when you start out in photography, it's easy to make huge leaps. You know, after you figure out how to get your focus, boom, huge leap forward in your photography. After you finally figure out Lightroom, huge leap forward in your photography. And you get to this like competent level and you plateau. And then the way to press forward at that point is like 1,000 little tips. You know, you look at hundreds, thousands of photos over and over, just looking at other people's photos. And then when you're out shooting, all that little tiny knowledge, those little things you've seen and heard and experienced all work together. And that's what enables you to make the really, truly beautiful stuff. It's not all about just the big pieces and skipping all the stuff that seems hard to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. In the end, like once you reach a certain level, everything comes in baby steps. And, you know, you're making small progress, you know, just trying to outdo yourself just a little bit at a time. And whether it's, you know, a slightly less noisy image or a slightly sharper focus, you know, things come in little bits once you reach a certain point. So that's the people that are really nerding out about, you know, the newest ISO performance. It's because we're trying to milk out the very most out of our cameras. Like, okay, I can already do this with my camera, but I wish that I could do this. And so we spend a lot of time just like daydreaming over, you know, how to get a slightly cleaner image or how to get a slightly sharper lens. And I think it's just a natural place to be once you reach a certain point, I think.
And in that vein, Stuart Laird wants the best recommendation for a 70 to 200 millimeter f2.8 lens for ice hockey pitchers. He says he settled for the Sigma OS f2.8 version because of a budget. And now some articles have put doubts in his head of it giving him soft focus. And he's also heard that the Tamron version is slow on focus. So what are your thoughts on this, guys? I mean, I think that the Tamron is just fine for my needs. I've used it for action stuff, and I use it every other weekend for a wedding when I have one.
I've pretty much only used my Canon, and I can tell you that the Canon one like focuses just crazy fast, and it's crazy sharp. Everything that I've read, the Tamron is just as sharp, but it doesn't focus quite as fast. But what I would say about hockey is if that's the main sport you're going to be shooting, like, I wouldn't worry about the focus speed too much, because most of the movement, most of the action is actually like horizontal. You know, unless they're skating right towards you, that's the only time that you're going to notice a difference in focus speed, I think. So, you know, I don't think that you're going to notice the focus speed as much with hockey as you would some other sports. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I think that's great. The 70-200 is an absolutely awesome sports lens. The Canon, it focuses like lightning fast. The Nikon focuses lightning fast. The Fuji focuses lightning fast. The Tamron, you know, it focuses lightning fast. Is it as fast as the Canon and Nikon? No. This is more of like a 2-3% kind of thing. We're talking about it's a tiny bit slower. Mm-hmm. And so if you have, you know, unlimited funds to pay for the Canon and Nikon, yeah, you probably should. But if you are like a normal human being and not a trust fund baby, go buy the Tamron. It's so much less expensive. It's like tiny 2% less focus. Maybe one photo out of 500 is not going to be quite as in focus as the Canon. Big whoop. So I say save the money and get the Tamron. I've shot with it. It is great. You're going to get excellent results. If I were buying today, and I'm a gear hound, I would buy the Tamron. It's just so much cheaper and almost the exact same thing. All right, Mark Franks. Mark is a friend. He shot with us in Iceland. He's asked me if I'm still having trouble running Lightroom on my iMac. Yes, I am. I'm having trouble running Lightroom on my iMac. I'm having trouble running Lightroom on my MacBook Air. And Windows users are having trouble with it as well. Now, if you're just using Lightroom casually, you may not notice a real big difference here. But for those of us who live in Lightroom and knows what it feels like when it's faster, like it used to be, we're all just dying right now. Since the new update that we got, that was supposed to be a speed update, I mean, it has just been like sludge walking through Lightroom. I saw beach balls several times today while I was trying to work in Lightroom. Beach balls in Mac speak is when you get the timer. The Mac, you don't get a timer, you get a little spinning beach ball. Anyway, I kept getting beach balls. It's just a lot slower than it ever has been. And I don't know why, because it now will address more RAM. They're making it use a lot more resources, but it's terrible. So I'm very upset with Adobe. I want to see a quick result on this, and it's been months and months. It's still very slow.
I've been experiencing the exact same thing. Really buggy, I've been using it enough to where I'm getting used to the slower uh-huh. performance. Like, you know, I reminisce about the old days back when I didn't have to wait for smart previews to be built before I could start to do anything. Because while previews are being built, it pretty much just like almost locks up Lightroom. I can't do mm-hmm. anything. And there's lots of times where it doesn't load the previews correctly. It'll just give me like a black photo instead of the actual photo. So I'm going through all the same things. Sometimes when I go, Control M for panorama, you know, it's the panorama hotkey. It'll just like randomly export. So it's just start exporting files, or it'll just do random things. It'll do something different every time. Like I'll go Control M and it'll just like start sending files over to Photomatics or something. Like it
control mystery.
Yeah. It's like the surprise button. It's crazy. So I'm going through the same things.
And Ed Shanahan writes in, he's asking about using a RAID system and kind of having it be a painless process for his RAID system that's in his office, and then using a laptop on the field. And I think that it is pretty painless. It's something that I was overthinking, and even overthinking and how to explain it to people. My system, and it might be different for what you guys are doing, but I will shoot my photos out in the field. I'll edit them if I have time to edit them in the field. And then I just go ahead
on the laptop.
And then I'll right click on the images or the folders inside Lightroom, and I'll click Show in Finder, which is also probably Reveal in Microsoft Explorer.
Yeah. Yep.
And then from there, I'll copy and paste those folders over to my external RAID drive system at my house. And then I'll just go into Lightroom's import dialog box, navigate to those folders in the external RAID drive system, and add them to the library. That way Lightroom's not moving any files around, and it reads your XMP files for your edits. It's pretty painless.
Right. So there's one thing you have to make sure you've done if you're doing this system, and that's the same workflow that I do, is in Lightroom, you have to go into your preferences, catalog settings, and tick the box that says automatically write changes to XMP files. That's not the default. You do need to do that, because otherwise when you transfer the photos, you just lost all your edits. Mm-hmm. But you have to tick that box, which everyone should do. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. The other problem that you'll have with this system is if you use virtual copies in Lightroom, which I often do, but I keep reminding myself not to do anymore because of this when I'm on my laptop. Let's say I make an edit of a photo in Lightroom, and then I say, I like that, but I want to try a totally different edit. So I right click on that photo and say, create a virtual copy. And now it doesn't create two files. It just pretends there are two files there, and it lets you make a totally different edit, and then you can edit them side by side. Your virtual copies are going to be completely lost if you go this route. So don't do anything with virtual copies if you're doing it this way. But if you don't do it the way that Darren recommends and I back up, then it's just a pain in the rear. You got to move your photos and you got to import your other catalog. Ah, don't do that. It's just much easier to paste the photos over with the XMP changes. All right. Rob Genesi, now we know how to say his name, says, how often do you guys dodge and burn in Photoshop and Lightroom? Is that something you do a lot, Nick?
Yeah, I do quite anytime that I have a landscape that I'm proud of and like this is going to be something I'm going to print, I always dodge and burn. And, you know, sometimes I do it in Lightroom, sometimes I do it in Photoshop. When I do it in Photoshop, the method that I do is I create a new layer, I change the blend mode of that layer to overlay, and then I actually select color. Different colors, and I'm actually dodging and burning with color. So if I select a dark color anywhere I paint that, it's not only going to add a little bit of saturation of that color, but it's also going to darken it down a little bit, or vice versa. I can brighten up certain colors, and I can add glows to the sky and all kinds of stuff. When I do it in Lightroom, I'm obviously using an adjustment brush, and I like to actually just do it with the white slider, which I'm excited is in the newest update in Lightroom. That's one of the things they did right, is there's a whites and a black slider in the adjustment brush now. So like if I'm brightening up an area, I like to bring up the whites. If I'm darkening an area down, I like to just subtly bring down the shadows. So that's how I do dodge and burning. And I love dodge and burning because it adds so much more dimension to a shot. I can look at an image that I really like, and it's just night and day when I've used dodge and burn to create more dimension. It's amazing the difference it can make. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a lot more questions we hope to get to in next week's episode, but we want to get onto the doodads of the week very quickly. And before we do that, I want to remind you about our improved photography lens finder. This project took me over a year and thousands of dollars that we invested into making it so it could ask you 5 questions. And if you answer the questions, bang, you get a result. There were a couple bugs when we first released it, but I've worked through those now. And you're going to get a reliable, excellent answer every time. I consulted with the world's best photographers to make this project happen and make sure that the lenses that we recommend are the very best top-notch stuff. I mean, Ben Von Wong, Lindsay Adler, Martin Bailey, Juan Pons, Darren Meller, Jim Goldstein, Victor Bezrukov, Ian Plant, Jeff Cable, Brendan Van Son, Josh Rossi, Ken Kamineski. We had, I mean, the dream team of photographers put their advice into this. So be sure to check it out at improvephotography.com and click on Lens Finder. If you're going to be buying a lens, please go check out that lens finder before you do it. It can save you a lot of money. We're taking budget into account to get you the very best lens. So I hope you enjoy that. And let's get on to the doodads of the week. Darren, what you have?
Mine's simple. It's a clear umbrella that you can get from Wally World, which is Walmart. Just grab a clear umbrella. Erica mentioned this and I thought really nothing of it. And I had an engagement shoot that turned out to be pretty rainy and everyone got soaked and I learned my lesson, bought myself a clear umbrella, and it has saved a ton of shoots from being rained out and actually created some pretty dynamic looks.
Very cool. Nick, how about you?
Mine is actually the sky replacement tutorial course that we finally have up over at improvephotography.com/sky replacement. I'm excited.
Oh, but it's so expensive, Nick. I can't buy it.
Yeah, it's a whopping $10. So the price of maybe two iced mochas, you can improve your photography. And you know, I'm fairly proud of the tutorials. We've gotten lots of positive response. They're selling like hotcakes.
So what are they
going
to get? What's it teaching them how to do?
Everything. Absolutely. No. We basically, I just go through step by step on how to prepare your files, how to choose the right sky, how to make a really detailed, intricate selection of the sky. You know, we're talking about skies that have trees and bushes breaking the horizon line. How do you go through and make a realistic selection of that? And then how do you blend in a sky and make it actually look real? Blending in a sky isn't that hard, but making it look real and selling the illusion, that is. So that's what we're kind of focusing on. It's over an hour of content. I think it's 7 videos, something like that, for $10. You can't beat that. That's like, what, $1.35 per video. So
it's really awesome. And really, just to get the backgrounds from Nick and I, these are, you know, skies that we've shot different backgrounds. So if you want like your own library of photos, like, you know, you take a picture of a house and you want a nice sunset in it, well, Nick's going to teach you in the video series. And then we have the backgrounds for you right there. You can just download the raw files and they're totally yours. You want to use this on a commercial project? Go right ahead. Don't give us any attribution. You want to use this on a personal project? Go for it. These are yours. Use them. So for $10, this is a pretty cool value. And my doodad this week is I'm going to give one lucky listener of the podcast, one lucky listener of the podcast, a free copy of Nick's sky replacement tutorial. And that is to somebody who will go to improvephotography.com and comment on this episode 141. Just click on podcast for and then episode 141. Anybody who has seen the movie Here Comes the Boom. Just go write your name in their comment, and then we will email you if you are the lucky winner of Nick's sky replacement tutorial. Here Comes the Boom, I might say, is the best movie of all time. It's better than Photography, and that's hard to say. So go check out episode 141. If you've seen the movie Here Comes the Boom, go ahead and just write any kind of comment, and we'll pick one lucky listener to get Nick's sky replacement tutorial. And be sure to go to improvephotography.com/sky replacement and pick it up for $10. Crazy value. I'm sure you'll love it. Thanks for joining us, everybody, this week, and we'll see you in another 7 days.